This is Rick and I talking about
it was like one of those movies that always played on UHF channels, like on a Saturday afternoon. It'd be The Dirty Dozen and The Great Escape, and you'd see like it was always a lot of like Steve McQueen movies.
Back then, we never would see the full movie. If it was a during the day movie on the weekend, you'd always just come upon it because you just didn't know it was
going to
be there.
Yeah.
So you just see these movies from particular places, and you'd have to fill in the backstory. You know, you'd be like, all these guys are on the cliff in the Eager Sanction, and you'd be like, okay, there's a German, there's a French guy, and what are they? They have to be going after Hitler, probably.
Yeah, it's got it. So it was always a World War II movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was always some kind of theme of World War II. Yeah. Yeah, it's funny how our youth was so shaped by that. It'd be like by watching fuzzy UHF channels, watching like Creature Double Feature and cartoons and all of this post-World War II era movie making.
Even the like the Creature Double Feature, they would have that theme song. The Creature Double Feature on Channel 56666. And these things with these little tiny bits of sound would like burn into your brain.
Now, the Creature Double Feature continues with Godzilla on Monster Island here on WLVI TV.
But I mean, that little theme that some guy probably at the dumb UHF channel came up with,
and it was very lo-fi, low-tech kind of stuff.
Yeah, it was awful.
And yeah, but I think in the context of what you had to watch, that would speak to you at the time at that age. I mean, what was your alternative? It was like, you know, Starsky and Hutch and.
It was like prison.
There was
like
network television was so un. It didn't. It was so unrelatable in some ways. For some reason, that became part of our culture. This like UHF kind of, you know, whatever was on those fuzzy channels, was kind of became our little.
Well, that was like the fun. That felt like it was the fun part of TV, where it was like the adults weren't paying attention, and so there was this secret club. Of odd clown adults had decided to put on monster things and cartoons, and maybe the adults on the regular channels didn't even know about it. Like they were, whenever the adults on ABC would turn around, like UHF would hide behind the curtain. And it felt like you were getting away with something. Like, I can't believe they put on the thing that I want. Because so much of when you're little, the world seems designed to be the thing that you don't want. Here's, you know, school. Everything felt like sort of shackles-based. And then UHF, there was this freedom. Like, I want to see monsters when I'm little, and here they are.
And you felt like when you turned it on and it was kind of low-grade and grainy and the signal didn't come in quite right, it felt like you were pulling in something forbidden, something that was of another world. And much like radio stations, I think, were, you know, if you found that radio station, that particular station at night or something, it only came in at night on AM or something like that, it was like, I'm getting something. This is clandestine.
It's like anything you wanted felt illicit.
Exactly. And I'm sure that's nowadays, you know, kids would feel that way with online in a certain way. You know, by connecting on social media, they have their networks that the adults don't know about. You know, but we had that kind of old analog style of having to tune a knob and play with the, you know, a coat hanger antenna to try to get just that thing.
It was so hard.
We had to
dig. We had to do all these things, these moves, and then we had to be lucky. As a kid, you don't know what's happening. You're just like walking around, going, I don't know, and then you turn on the TV, hoping, you know. And then it is Dracula. You'd be like,
"Yeah, exactly." And that it became an event because you never knew it was going to come up,
right?
You know, it was like on a 4 o'clock on a rainy Saturday afternoon, and you'd be sitting there and just flip on the television. You're trying to, and then you'd fine tune it, and all of a sudden,
right?
Oh, it's Frankenstein.
Frankenstein. How cool is that?
And you really believe that you can bring life to the dead? That body is not dead. It has never lived. I created it. I made it with my own hands from the bodies I took from graves, from the gallows, anywhere. Go and see for yourself.
And the other thing is that this, whenever I would have that experience, I would assume, I don't know what this kind of a solipsism or narcissism, I would assume that all the people I know, all my friends at school, had also had the exact same experience and had themselves luckily stumbled upon the show. And I would look forward to talking about on Monday or whatever, mm-hmm. when we go back to school, the Dracula. And the weird thing was is that often it was true.
It's
that
true.
They had yeah. had the, they're like, yes, I saw Dracula too.
Well, I think you had more of a chance back then because you probably had 3, 4, 5 channels of television in
right.
any one city you lived in. And then same thing with radio. There were only so many radio stations that you could pick up in your town. And there was only going to be so many options for any kind of entertainment like that for any kid to find. So your chances were pretty good that there would be that shared experience.
Right.
Where I think nowadays, of course, there's everything available to everyone at any time. Everybody can be off on their own little domain and doing things. Of course, you can share it easier now.
Right.
You know, you can kind of, those communities are now more widespread. But as far as your, in a geographical sense, for your little, you know, circle of friends that you knew, you know, it was much more easy to have that shared experience.
Right. Yeah. Well, I don't know if you do this with your kids, but and I've only done it once and then I gave up on it. But I thought it would be nice if Sam was watching a show as it played live on TV. You know, like, so they had this new show on the Cartoon Network, mm-hmm. The Dragon, How to Train Your Dragon show. And it's on 8 o'clock or whatever. And I thought, wouldn't it be nice? I was doing something for myself. It really wasn't for him. If he watched this show that was live, instead of us recording it and watching it 3 days later or whatever, thinking that somehow other kids were watching it live and then he could have some shared experience with them. He could go to school and, did you watch the Dragon show last night? But, you know, that doesn't exist. There's no, we don't have any shared context in that way.
My 10-year-old doesn't, rarely watches things live. Everything is... you know, recorded on demand or whatever, Netflix kind of stuff. It's just like she'll have a thought like, oh, I'd like to catch a couple episodes of this show. And she just turns it on. And she might do it on her computer in her room or right. she might do it down in the living room. But it doesn't, there's no sense of, oh, that event. Oh, 8 o'clock tonight, the show's coming on.
Right.
You know, that anticipation that my wife and I still use occasionally for a few shows that we do watch. We're like, oh, yeah, I wonder. I think the new one's coming out. It's going to start at 9 o'clock.
Right.
But I don't think her generation has that same feeling because they didn't have to.
Right.
And it's funny how quickly that's changed because I think just 8 or 10 years ago, it was still pretty rare for people to do that. I mean, outside of the world of, you know, video recording that we've all had, I think that whole idea of being able to just get anything at any time and watch it is such a new phenomenon.
Right. Well, I wonder, too, if I mean, I think that we're treating sporting events are the new shared cultural experience. I mean, nobody really wants to watch something that's, you know, the game from yesterday. I mean, unless you're you know, that particular Oscar Madison kind of guy. But maybe that, in part, is why sports are so popular. So whenever there's a game on, all of a sudden everything on Twitter is about the Patriots for me.
Yeah.
Or on Facebook, and they're just like posts about, like, I can't believe he just did that. And everybody else, I'm assuming, in my little Twitter world is understanding what these little references are, too. But I'm not really a sports guy.
I feel like you and I are the only two people on earth who don't pay attention to football.
I think I could.
I can take it or leave it. I don't feel like the hype to me is way overdone. I have a hard time watching any kind of football event because that's what they are. They're not games. They are day-long
right.
events with a capital E where, you know, it starts at 6 a.m. and it's just this build-up and hype and ridiculous music and graphics and basically a lot of washed-up athletes just saying, you know, cliche things for 6 hours before the game. But to me, the actual game itself, it's like, that could be interesting for a little bit to me.
Yeah.
But I can't get past the culture of it.
Don't you feel, though, I don't ever want to, I don't ever tell people that I don't like football. I'm a little embarrassed that I don't. Like,
I
so
used to
I
be
just
that
really
way.
Like,
yeah, I used to feel that way.
And now you're out and proud.
Yeah, I guess I am. I just don't care. I mean, I like baseball. I'll pay attention. I don't even, I listen to some sports radio only for about 9 months out of the year. Like, I don't pay attention to sports radio this time of the year because there's nothing about except Pat's talk.
Do they broadcast football live on the radio? Is that a broadcast?
They do, yeah. You can get football on the radio. I don't know if people listen to it on the radio. Like, I never thought that people would listen to a football game on the radio.
The pace seems all wrong. You know,
it does.
Football
yeah.
has, it requires the long visual of guys just milling around.
There's nothing better made for television than football is like tailor-made for television
right.
viewing, especially like, you know, on the big HD, you know, screen kind of thing. It's like that's, you know what I mean? It
yeah,
seems
well,
like it's tailor-made.
The drama of it is mm-hmm. so, it has this sine wave of absolutely nothing for 5 minutes and then these intense sharp jags that are, some of them can just be skyscrapers of excitement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, and then you're back down. It's this constant coming and going of like restful, anxious waiting, and then amazing, blurry-brained excitement when, you know, are they going to get the first down? Are they going to get
yeah.
the touchdown? The time
and you
is
need that
away.
Wide shot that shows everything that's going on at that moment
right.
to convey that. I think it's, I would think that would be so hard to convey as a play-by-play announcer. Baseball is, on the other hand, seems tailor-made for the audio medium. It seems like radio, and maybe that's because of that kind of quaint, you know, feeling of old-timey America, baseball and old-timey radio. You know, I don't know, maybe that's it.
Two balls, no strikes to Bob Speak. One out in the first inning, no score. Koufax right back, and the fastball is inside. Ball three. 3-0. Koufax at this moment, and of course it's only the second batter, is not nearly as fast as he was in Chicago. However, he's trying to loosen up, and right now he bent over and tried to touch his toes. 3-0 the count. Sandy ready and delivers. Fastball low, ball four. So Bob Speak draws the walk with one out in the first inning. Ernie Banks batting 231.
Football to me feels of the now, and it's very sledgehammer. It's very relentless.
Mm-hmm.
Baseball, summertime, it feels a little more laid back. It feels a little more cinematic.
Right. I know what you mean. Well, it almost seems like football is not, there's so much more that's making the football experience. As you said, it's a whole sprawl of hours, and it's filled with all these mm-hmm. other things. It's almost like the game itself is one part of eight different segments,
mm-hmm.
whereas the baseball game is always the center. You know, you can't, there's so many games in a season, you can't take one and turn it into the prom, which is what they sort of do with every football game. There's only 12 games, is that right?
Yeah, it's such a short, compact season, and there's so few teams. Yeah, and there's only a game a week.
Yeah.
And it's such a giant event. But that kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier. That's the communal event of our time.
Yeah.
That's when everybody gets together now, and that shared experience. Another thing is I don't think with football, there are a lot of people that watch a game alone.
Right.
Football is always a shared experience. Baseball, because there are so many games, there's a game almost every single day. It happens. It's a very long process. It can be 4 hours, you know.
Mm.
I think a lot of people experience it alone, like they do with radio. Radio can be a very personal medium. And television, and especially football, it feels... like it's an event, like it's
right.
a shared experience. Radio is very personal. Baseball can be a very personal
right.
thing.
They should do a baseball season that's just 12 games. You know, it takes place exactly in the same style as the football season, just to see. I know you'd hate that.
I think, I don't. Yeah, exactly.
You love the massive career. Games. You're like getting antsy over there.
I don't know. I don't want every game to have that kind of stature.
Right.
Well, playoffs do, obviously. Playoff games do. And of course, when you get to divisional and World Series games. But
the penny ante quality of the average day-to-day game, it's nice that there's sort of like, you could get as worked up about a single game as the World Series if it's the right feeling game.
Mm-hmm.
But also at the same time, you know it doesn't matter. You're going to have another game tomorrow. So you get that weird experience of like, it could be the greatest game and I could get all kinds of crazy about it, but it doesn't even matter
mm-hmm.
in some ways because we'll just move on. Whereas with football, you know, there's that live and die feeling.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's much more intense. But, you know, when we're talking about football, I started feeling like, well, why aren't we watching this? You know, it's a cultural event. Well, the way we described it sounded really exciting. I was picturing the fields and all these guys. And you know, we're sitting over here going, yeah. I would stick with my baseball broadcasts all by myself. Why are we such lonely world
know.
Haters?
It sounds like we're just pathetic old guys sitting in the stands with scorecards. But
what if we are? What if that sounds and, like is more than
wrong with
is,
that.
Is
I,
like?
Yeah, I just I don't
or are.
No, we're actually two married men with young children, and I think you know
just trying to get by.
I have friends, sort of.
Right,
they're all baseball fans.
All of your friends are listening to different baseball
no,
games late at night on their own radio.
I would
transistor.
Gather most of the people that I do know, I think, do watch football.
Me too.
Maybe not, you know, they're not necessarily painting their face, but they, I don't know anybody who doesn't.
Somebody invited me to a football game, a friend, mm-hmm. and this feeling of like, I don't even know what the feeling was that entered me. It was sort of like this dread, this sense of boredom, as though something was like almost attacking me. Because because for a moment I had to entertain the idea of, yes, I must go to this invitation. But the feeling of experiencing it, I don't know why I was so resistant to it. It's this thing that everybody else is like, can't wait to experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel bad about that.
I don't think you're alone in that experience. I think a lot of people probably feel that way, but they haven't been outed yet.
You think?
Yeah.
So you think there's a little bit of a masquerade going on with the football?
They're not in the pride parade like you and me.
So this is
coming out saying they're not football fans.
So this is not, I mean, I think football is maybe considered the number one sport in America now.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure it is by far now. Yeah.
Is that well known?
I think so. Well, I think it's become, in the last probably 20, 25 years, most watched, I would think. Maybe I'm wrong of that. Maybe it's less time. But I think it's more watched than baseball.
And what about... what is the ranking? I mean, would it be football, baseball, basketball, hockey?
I don't have any stats for it, but I would
professional
think so.
Wrestling, racing, car racing. I mean, those things probably have more.
NASCAR, I'm sure, for a while was, I know that their big claim to fame was like the fastest growing spectator sport, which I don't know what that means. I guess that means like the most attended. But of course, they play it, you know, they race in stadiums that like seat 100,000 people.
Are those different, like, is that the only thing that happens at a NASCAR thing? They just have an enormous track. And, I mean, they don't play football
games.
No, right?
It's all they go around in an oval, right? It's not like Formula One, like in Europe, where they have an actual, like, track where they have turns and, like, it's a full-on
course. Do they
course.
Still do that?
Yeah.
I don't ever hear about any Formula One races.
Yeah.
I guess we're so NASCAR in this country, right?
We're so insular that we don't care about Europe.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure anybody.
I don't care.
I'm not
them.
Sure most Americans can place Germany on a map.
No.
So I don't think we worry about it. I think it's.
I mean, I know it's a little bit above and to the right of. I mean, I use France. I have France mm-hmm. and I have England. Those are my markers.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, I know everything's vaguely to the right.
I know Italy is a boot. I know.
Right.
I know that. That's different than the Canadian boot.
A boot. I've got those three locked down, and I know where Canada is, but I'll never go there. I never think about it. I mean, if Canada were 3 inches north of my house, I would never think about going there. Even though it's an hour and a half from where I live.
It's essentially the 51st state. You should take a visit.
Nice. I want. I just, every once in a while, I think, well, we should go to Canada.
They got plumbing installed. They're pretty good now.
I don't know what I picture when I picture Canada. I can't imagine that society continues up there. It's like when you drive north in New Hampshire, you feel like you're going into an ever-increasing wild. So I can't imagine, it suddenly blooming up into a city. So I don't actually believe in
Toronto.
You
think like you get over the border and it's just like a lot of big trees and then ice. Like it's a big forest that just suddenly gives way to the Arctic Circle.
Right.
And there's some polar bears.
It is, the Arctic Circle, but with a couple more trees.
Yeah. I think they actually have some territory between that and the border. I think there's actually...
I don't know.
I picture a lot of people looking like Rick Moranis. This is another thing about my age, I guess. I just picture a lot of like second tier comedians in winter jackets.
Just wandering around going like, I'm not sure how I can get back in, but when I do, I'm going to make it.
Yeah. I just, a lot of people that look like Geddy Lee and those two cats that were big, I guess, at one point.
Actual cats?
Two cats. Those big hats.
Oh, yeah, like, yeah. I thought it was like toucans, two cats.
Whatever they call them.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. And then I guess that's it.
Molson?
Yep, that's it. Yep, the leaf on the bottle.
Right. They tried. Yeah. They tried to make that the Heineken of
North
American
America.
Imports.
Yeah,
but
they did.
We just were like, you know what? Yeah. That's Canadian for beer, mate. We may have mixed our beer metaphors.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Again, to most Americans, Australia, Canada, you know what I mean? You could reverse them on the globe,
right.
And they'd be like, oh. Okay.
Right. So one is full of prisoners and one is full of potential comics.
Correct.
Right?
Which, incidentally, could end up being much the same.
Right.
Yeah.
It is a similar breeding mix.
But
why don't we ever, like, if you have any friends that go to Canada, they'll come back and they'll be raving about it. And yet that doesn't do a single thing to the Canadian tour. I don't care. You could tell me they're giving away money and chocolate right at the border, and I wouldn't care.
It was interesting to me because a while back we went down to Disney World, and they have, you know, Epcot Center, which has like this, you know, the ring of nations.
They don't have Canada, do they?
They do have Canada. And it had one of the most impressive, they had actually built in this, like, you know, Las Vegas style way, they had built like a series of mountain ranges in their little area, their exposition area, with like a big building lodge. And I mean, it when you were in this can, you could look up and you felt like you were in the Canadian wilderness. I mean, it was really huge. It was pretty impressive.
So,
again, in that kind of, you know, shiny Disney Las Vegas sort of way.
There's an adjective for that. It's Canadian-y.
It was very Canadian-y.
Yeah.
And it was funny because it was probably the most impressive of the built-up, you know, displays of a particular nation. Yet it was the least, it was desolate. Nobody was in it.
Right.
And a lot of people were over, like, in the British area because they had, like, you know, the British pub and all that. And
see,
people are drinking. And
Canada's,
you know,
always getting treated like that.
They even had live music. They had a band playing. They must have been Canadian, I would imagine. Wouldn't you have to if you were, like, the Canadian display? It was a rock band. It was, you know.
I think of Canada in that way. I mean, they have a lot of great alternative indie bands. That's
They have a disproportionate amount of comics.
Right.
Good rock bands. I mean, there's only like, I think there's only 12 people in the entire country, right?
It's very small.
Yeah.
The population compared to the size.
During tourism season, I think they're up to 15. But I think there's only like a dozen people that live there full time.
Like a couple. They keep a couple in each province.
Yeah. But I mean, literally, it's like not even a dozen full-time residents in the entire country. And they have like, they own like 25% of the comedians on TV.
Right.
And I think, and then something like, you know, 40% of the good rock bands in North America.
That doesn't make sense.
The non-British rock bands.
I don't find that fair.
It is. It's strange. It seems strange.
I mean, is it the loneliness that gets all these people, these several people, into the mood to make their jangly independent music that's different and striking, or why? I don't like that a nation could create. Just the fact of the nation could make these people special, because you would want that yourself. If it takes the shape of a cold continent to make me a comedian, I'd take it. I'd be Canadian for that.
That's interesting. I think we've uncovered something here. I think that Canada could potentially be the greatest nation on earth per capita. Does that make sense? Is that a stat?
I think you could turn that into an acronym, but I can't, you know, GNEPC.
It's like the most creative country per capita, maybe.
That's an interesting idea.
I'm thinking about that.
Because then they could use that in the tourism thing. That probably mm-hmm. still wouldn't work, but just to get the idea out there.
We've got the most Canadianists
right.
people, eh?
Right.
I don't know how that would work, but you could do something like that. You could have...
Well, I wonder if that says something about us, too. I mean, maybe we're just not trying very hard. You know, we're like, you know, we don't have to do... I sometimes wonder about America being... We have too many successful things before us, too much...
We're resting on our coattails? Is that... We're kind of like fat and happy?
How can you compete? I mean, if you're just sitting in your little place in the middle of the country... And you're seeing all these, this parade of stars, which we seem to see, you know, even on YouTube or even in your own choosed, selected media, you know, there's still stars. So I almost feel like there's this, I don't know if we can cross that gap or we'd want to. I think there's a setup where we don't have that Canadian sensibility like, hey, you know, I'm going to go become one of those. And I think they have that. I think they tell them that. But I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
Hey, do you...
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm a creative type.
All right. It's 10:49, 19 minutes after Rick's meeting.
This is the one thing about being a morning host.
Freedom
is
like
once
this.
In a while you can pull a little bit of, I had other things to do.
Right.
Yeah.
That's...
And so, I don't... I wouldn't suffer a lot of that. If I were in charge, and I don't pull a lot of that. But every once in a while, you can say, you know what? I've got other things going. And the people that are in charge of the meetings,
yes,
they don't give you a hard time about that for certain people.
I really admire you.
You can.
Right now.
There are certain leverages, and you have to pick your battles. But if you pick them correctly, you do not get bothered.
We have to say, though, that right now there's a room right now, close to us, where very important people in very nice outfits are waiting with sharpened pencils, touching yellow legal pads.
They're not waiting.
And there's an empty chair that has your name on the back, like a director.
Yeah. No? But they're sitting quietly with their hands folded.
Right.
And they're not tapping those pencils.
Right.
They're waiting for Mr. Ganley.
They know.
Yeah.
They know. This, they're on his dime.
I think you have an inflated sense of
no,
my ego.
No.
Yeah, I think you do. I don't think that any of them are even, I don't even think they're remotely concerned at this very moment.
I can see them from here.
I think the meeting is going on without.
No, they are delighted to be in the position of having to wait for you. They can think of nothing better.
I don't think they're waiting on me one bit. Mm-hmm. I think a check mark silently was left undone in somebody's head, but that's about it. And then I will check in with them later and say, I was Mr. Hurley. Art was being made.
I wouldn't say, don't tell them you're with me, though. Just say you.
I'll say it was Mr. Colgan.
Yes.
I'll
because
say
if
Mr.
you
Colgan.
Say it was with me, they'll sure. be like, I don't think.
No, that's the great thing about this is why I wanted to work in this medium. There's none of that. It's not. I don't shave every day.
Yeah.
I don't have to dress up like they do.
Right.
I don't have to worry about.
When you say they, you mean your colleagues?
Well, just the people that put up meetings.
Okay.
The managers.
Do they dress well?
I've been a manager. I don't want that.
Well, you were a manager at a radio station, though.
Yeah, I've managed a radio station.
So that's
it's just small staffs, but when the people that you're managing come in dressed up better than you, you know.
Right.
I just don't.
It doesn't feel right.
I don't feel like I really need to be there.
Mm. Yeah.
I like being on this end of it.
Well, then you kind of just roll. It's like you're in charge of your own little boat, and you're going to take it mm-hmm. where you like. After a certain while, I mean, you can't just do that from day one. You have to sit here for a year or two,
mm-hmm.
let some of the other senior staff fade away, move on to other jobs until you're a little bit senior
it's
yourself.
It's time spent.
Right.
Yeah, it's time spent. Well, you know, you live an independent lifestyle. There's no real...
It's grand. It's grand.
It's full of riches beyond your belief.
Yeah.
Beyond, you know, beyond your dreams.
I was reading, Kurt Vonnegut's letters right now.
Mm-hmm.
And he's writing this letter to his dad. He's just published gotten his first sale of a short story to Collier's. So he sold his first short story. It's like 1723, the year. And he made $750 for this short story. Back, it was actually 1949 or something like that.
Yeah.
But I've never gotten close to getting that much money for anything I've ever done.
He was $750 for the...
For his first short story that he sold to Collier's. Yeah.
Now, in 1945 or 9 or whatever that must have been, that's a lot of money.
It was 6 weeks' salary. He was working at GE as a flack, a publicity man at GE, and it would have counted as 6 weeks of salary. So he was very excited, and he was ready to move on to a life as a short story writer, as he hoped. He didn't quite work out that way. He struggled. You know, he had a good year. His first year, when he published that, he published like everything he sent out. He published, and then the next year, hard times, and then he had to take up another job.
That sounds like the life of a freelancer, though.
Yeah, yeah. I took a class with the guy who edited the Vonnegut letters. His name is Dan Wakefield. I took a class with him at Emerson College, and he was teaching a sort of how to write magazine articles type of program. It's kind of like the art of nonfiction. We read all the new journalism, Tom Wolfe and stuff like that. But Dan Wakefield knew everybody. He was friends with Vonnegut, and he used to tell us stories about him. But one thing Wakefield always told us was that there's hardly anybody in America who's ever made it as a freelance writer. And he actually brought in the one guy in the country
who was making it. We found the rare bird.
Yeah.
We've caged him.
It was a guy named John Seabrook. And John Seabrook came in just to sort of to let us know how he could juggle this, how it would all work out. I don't remember any of his advice.
But he really did. He lived exclusively on freelance nonfiction writing?
Yeah. So he would write, you know, but he would write for the top magazines, you know, like Rolling Stone and Vanity Fair and things like that.
So he would spend a couple of months on a piece and get paid handsomely for it.
Right. So you can, I mean, if you're writing for those big magazines, you can make a big chunk of money, but you only get like one or two of those gigs a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's hard to string those together, and they don't come regular.
I mean, right.
When I read that he made $750 like so long ago, back when nobody made a nickel, you know, that was back in those old days, you make like $3 a week.
Yeah.
I just thought, what a changed world in terms of, you know, I would be so excited to get $750.
Yeah, and I think it's also a symptom of the fact that I think even medium-sized, you know, regional publications maybe 20 years ago would pay okay.
Yeah.
And I think that publishing in general in the last 10 years has just gone, you know,
it's
just so hard.
What a terrible time to do anything.
And online, I mean, you're not going to make anything to publish anything online. I mean, there's very few sites that really have any real readership to the level where they'd give you, you know, what a Rolling Stone would have given you 20 years ago.
Right. I mean, I wonder what the people, you know, if you contribute to Huffington Post or one of those places, you know, that seems like the abode of possible money for a freelance writer. But I still can't imagine they pay you more than, you know, $500.
I don't know.
Maybe they do, though.
That's a good, you know, it's a good question. I don't know. It was funny because I was watching, the other day, I was watching Where the Buffalo Roam, which was Bill Murray as Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah.
A pretty bad movie overall, but interesting if you're a Bill Murray fan anyway, just because it's early Bill Murray. And, you know, the antics of a Hunter S. Thompson is always interesting, I think. And the whole idea that he would spend all of this time and all of this the magazine's expense, they never said the name Rolling Stone in the movie. Obviously, right. It was kind of I think done on the cheap, so they didn't have the right to do that. But it was Rolling Stone, obviously, that he was writing for. And it was like there was no questioning, apparently, if you believe this movie, of all of the expenses and all the ridiculous things that the antics he would get into, and he'd get paid on top of that per word. And they would need 10,000 words by, you know, such and such a date. And it didn't matter how he got them, but, you know.
Everybody was rolling in dough back then. It was just like you probably know a million stories about radio, about, how it just, there's, you didn't have to do anything, just they'd be to hand you money.
Well, there was a lot of money even in smaller market radio up until a decade ago. I mean, it was just, not gobs being lobbed at you, but I mean, you know, if you got in the right position and you were in the right, you know, the right spot, you could do very well.
I'm full of regret that I, you know, it's like at the moment, like let's say the last year or two, I've been increasingly focused on freelance or increasing, it's in direct proportion with the money and the interest going down on both of those things. So it's like the moment I came to sell my chicken at the chicken show, everybody's like, you know what? We have a lot of chickens. Yours is just a regular old chicken.
Or even, we're just over chickens.
Yeah, we just don't even like them anymore.
We're eating.
We'll take it for free. You can let them live here in the area until somebody wants to eat them. But look at all the chickens. And I'm like, but this is what I want to do, is bring chickens to you.
Well, it's the same, I think, in any industry that doesn't sell anything that's a tangible product.
Mm.
Well, even that, I guess even retail. Of course, retail is different. You get everything online now. You don't have to.
It's all going away.
If everybody does everything, nobody gets anything. You know what I mean? There's no...
Is that a wise saying? I think it was.
If everybody can do it, if everybody can offer it.
Right.
Nobody's going to profit from it, really, because I did voiceover work from my home studio for years, and it was like it just got smaller and smaller and smaller. Now, you could argue proportionally that's because I didn't, A, have the talent, or B, I didn't market myself enough, which
is
probably true.
Yeah.
But it's also the fact that everybody with a computer and a closet had a studio now. And didn't need, you know, I mean,
the proverbial closet.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, it doesn't need to be, it's not as, if every DJ in the world was doing voiceover work and would do it for $10 or $20. And, you know, at that point, it's just, you know, you're competing for jobs that, you know, you're going to spend 2 hours on and make $5 from, but there's no point. Writing's become that way, I think, for a lot of people. Everything's just getting that way. Everything is just the Walmart way of doing it.
It really reflects poorly on us. I don't know how, but you know, what's strange is I feel like there's this terribleification of of culture.
That's a great term.
Well, it's really hard to say it. Go ahead and try.
Terribleification.
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 Well, that sounded like a swear.
Oh, it did, didn't it?
It did. Just in the middle there, but it was tucked in the middle, so I don't think. Yeah. But at the same time, this must be some dopamine receptor problem in my brain. I'm terribly hopeful about the future. I feel like we're heading into a great wild blue yonder, and yet at the moment, I'm like, this is all good things are. There's nobody wants them. Nobody's paying for them. If they exist, they exist in spite of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's, I almost feel like, you know, if there are great writers out there, they're not going to get published. If there are great music people out there, no one's going to hear them. If there's, you know, whatever the great is not being paid attention, and we don't want it. But I feel like it's still out there, and I feel like we're heading towards some wild blue yonder where it all gets connected up after we have this terrible moment of, like, you can sell your novel for about $5 online to one guy. That's it.
I feel the same way, and I also don't. I think we can come across as two, you know, older guys. Like back in the day, it was, you know. I think everybody gets that way a little bit to some degree, but the fact that everybody, anywhere, can publish to anybody anything, regardless of the you know, the cost of it or the profit margin, it's so easy now. To put something up and have people be exposed to it is only a good thing in the long run.
Right.
I would think that the fact that any kid that's just an aspiring writer or an aspiring film director, an aspiring musician could sit in their bedroom and create something of such good quality and value and such high quality, regardless of commerce, and he or she is not thinking about that. They just they have this overwhelming drive to be an artist, which is what a real artist is. They don't worry about the commercial value of it. No, you know, that can come later, or it won't. The point is they want to create the art. They have more medium now, more ways and to get it out.
Right.
And I think that's only a good thing.
I do. I agree with you, but I feel like there's something about, I think there's this Van Gogh aspect to our current cultural experience in terms of art. I feel like there's, nowadays, to be a successful artist, I think you have to mix together that business person, that promoter person, with the artist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of promoters happen to also have artistic skills, and they're the successful people of the now.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like there are a lot of I feel like the world is right now ribboned with Van Goghs doing their little thing in the field, isolated, and despite the opportunity presented by the internet, they can't penetrate. They can't do anything with it.
They're not marketing people. They're not promotional people.
And I don't know that artists usually are. I don't think they are. And I think we are in a place where we're increasingly without people that would help us in the old days. We don't have the patrons that we used to have.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
We don't have the publicity people. It's like if you're trying to get, if you're a writer right now and you want to sell a book, there are very few literary agents that are looking for an artistic work. They're looking for what's already out there and what works. They want a thriller that follows these things, and they're smart to do it because that's what makes money. And they want to make the big thing because there's all these authors out there that have published dozens of mystery books, dozens of this, but they're not making it. You know, they're no longer pulling it in.
The publisher won't even look at them until they've amassed so much in their social media circles or some kind of small sale somewhere. They have to already have a critical mass to bring there.
It's like they already have to develop some platform. Like, how do they?
Yeah. They don't want to nurture and develop talent.
Right.
Same thing with musicians. They're already looking for a band or an artist who has already got this big thing going somehow. They've already built their own little cult following. They're not willing to take somebody that think they have raw talent and nurture them along and develop them. They want the project ready-made to drop in and just make and blow it up bigger. Well, that's what they're looking for.
And I think what they want is they want Gangnam Style, but they don't necessarily want Psy, if that's what his name is.
Is that his name?
Psyops or something. The guy from Korea.
Yeah. So
it's almost like the hunger isn't, and it's an extension of the lack of nurturing of the potential creator. They want the song. They want to take that song like it's a commodity, make money out of it, and you can just disappear.
Yeah, the chef doesn't matter. It's just give me the food.
Yeah, because maybe you could come up with another song. I don't know. Maybe it's going to be another, you know, Gangnam Style 2, maybe, if you'll do that.
It's faceless, so anybody could do it.
Right, so it's just this hunt for the thing itself. It's for the thing that's going to make the money. It feels like that's not necessarily that important that it be anybody particular.
Well, it's a processed food kind of world. It's everything is served up in the bag, and you don't really care about who gave it to you. You know, you buy stuff at Walmart. Who cares where it came from or how it was made?
I wish I cared.
I got it for 88 cents less than I would have anywhere else.
But I'm the same way, you know?
We're all guilty. I'm not above that either. I'm saying I think that's
88 cents is a good price.
Culturally, that's what we've done. That's what we built up.
Right.
And that now we've gotten to the point where there is no alternative to that. I mean, it permeates everything in our lives. Is this kind of very fast, very cheap, and interchangeable world that we live in. And, you know, I'm not saying that there's no great, you know, there's some generally good aspects of that, I guess, and there are some, I think, generally sad consequences of it. But, you know, for better or worse, that's how we all are now.
I keep wondering how... is there a branch of social scientists who takes what's going, I guess futurist, but I don't know if that's really a person, who sort of takes a look at trends and things like that and then forecasts into the future.
Sure. Yeah.
Like, I would like to know where we're going. Like, I want to see, I want somebody to go, look, you're going to go through this period that's like this, then you're going to go through this. But I almost have a feeling that we've entered into an unstable information age where things are moving too quickly. It's sort of like asking the futurist to predict that Twitter would be important. You couldn't predict that.
I don't think there are people that do that all the time, I think, and, you know, write books to sell and all that. And I just don't think that any of the, if you look back, I read an interesting article, and I'm trying to remember when this was. It was sometime last year, about looking back, I think it was 25 years, at one of those old science magazines
that doesn't exist
anymore. And they predicted what, you know, 2012 was going to look like. And so they looked at those predictions. And, it's comical. It's really, because they were still talking about pod people and, you know, moon bases in 1986, you know. And it's just silly to look at that now. And I think it's just so hard. And I've also seen other, like the postcards from 1900 that were predicting what 2000 would look like.
Oh, right.
And there are always these people in Victorian dress,
right,
talking to giant megaphone microphones.
The dress seems the same, except they just have
never changes. Right. Yeah. And we're all still picturing we're all going to be in Star Trek leotards in 100 years and zipping around the stars.
I mean, that's actually pretty likely.
You know, it's just,
right?
I think all of that stuff is just kind of a, it's a fun drinking game, but it doesn't have any real value, in my opinion.
So what I was thinking, though, it seems like there would be, okay, there's that fun part, then, you know, that's almost like a pop cultural futurism. But I'm almost meaning, like, are there people that, because it seems like we're getting into this other place where, you know, like for the last election, there was that statistical modeling system that seemed to come up that was devised by some guy who predicted, you know, who was going to win the presidential election.
I can't remember his name. Yeah.
That guy.
Yeah.
I think it was.
But he did. Yeah. It was remarkable how close he was state by state.
So we're coming up with this weird, whatever, this new kind of calculus to look at movements of things, you know, they're doing with the stock markets and other things like that, like more and more and more advanced mathematics to look at the weather systems.
To model some really chaotic, seemingly chaotic.
Right. So I was thinking, like, is anyone doing that with our social experience? I'm curious, because I kind of would like to know, I'd like to know somebody who looked at this and was forecasting 10 years into the future. What's it going to look like? I'm just kind of curious. But maybe it doesn't exist. Maybe there's no math for it.
Well, if you would think scientifically, you would think that the more data points you have, in other words, the more data you can collect historically, that you could model just about anything.
Yeah.
Like if you think about weather, that seems like such an incredibly chaotic, a completely unpredictable thing. Like, how could you model something, say, 2 weeks in advance, like where a storm cloud is going to be? How could you possibly? Well, they're getting better at doing that.
Right.
You know, slowly but surely, the more data they've collected, they're predicting, like, you know, you look at that, you know, that Hurricane Sandy, how well that was predicted within just a few miles where that sent and the effects. I mean, they were predicting that 5, 6, 7 days ahead of time.
Right.
If you have enough data, you can predict almost anything. And that seems to be the way things are going. And yet, we just still seem so clumsy about predicting the future.
Right.
Like, I don't think, like 20 years ago, I wouldn't have thought that everyone would have this little box in their hand, this little slim piece of technology that you put in your coat pocket, and it would keep you in touch with anything, anywhere, at any time. Like, the fact that just 20 years ago,
right,
I wouldn't have predicted that would be the case.
I think even 5 years ago, when we had our little regular flip phones, we couldn't have seen, maybe, I don't know when the first iPhone came out, but we couldn't have seen how our world could have slipped right into the little heavy thing that we put in our pocket.
Yeah, I don't think you know, it wouldn't have seemed possible to me.
I love the clunky days, though, of 7 years ago when you had your silly flip phone, your camera. You had these three or four items that you had to try to fit in your pockets.
Yeah.
Those were good times.
And think about, you know, the late 90s. you know, like the heady days of the internet when that was going to change the world and there would be no more stories anymore and everything would be online and everything would be, you know, dial-up modems and that would save the world. And I think about like that fact back in the Napster days and all that. And how, like, we were still walking around with, like, cassette Walkmans.
Oh, yeah.
And those were just being replaced, you know, and you know, it just, to me, it's the pace is pretty incredible. But I'm also thinking that 100 years ago, when everybody started getting electric lights and the telephone in their house, and maybe a few people were just getting plumbing, you know, a lot of people probably didn't have it, how amazing... And how people would have thought that was a whirlwind.
Right.
You know, what if you were born in 1860, and so you were maybe 40 years old at the turn of the century, in the last century, and how things were changing so fast? You must be thinking, I cannot believe the pace.
Right.
It boggles my mind. And in one generation, it would have taken them weeks to get across the country in a wagon train. And, you know, by 1900, you could hop on a train, and any middle-class person with a middle-class salary could get to California,
right?
You know, in a couple of days on the train. Hmm. And how that must have just seemed mind-boggling, you know?
Doesn't it seem in some ways, though, like, doesn't it seem like the moment of now is, like, I can't see it changing. It feels like we've gotten to an edge of this is what it should look like. We've got the iPhone, we have iPads. But I can't imagine pushing into the next level of
jetpacks.
What are we going to be doing that's even more than that?
We need jetpacks. This is the answer.
Do you think people are working on the jetpacks?
And we need jetpacks that project shells over you that keep all the weather out. Like you would be able to fly around in a rainstorm and keep dry. Like it would have this force field. Like everybody's just going to be flying around in jetpacks in a big bubble.
So basically, if it was 1902 and you were a postcard designer,
what'd be doing? Yeah.
You'd be there's look, Victorian outfit and my jetpack.
Odd people with jetpacks. Yes.
See, that's our problem: is that we all go to the jetpack.
But we all go. It's funny. We all go back to this Jules Verne kind of. Everything goes back to Victorian era.
That guy messed us up in terms of like our imagination.
Really did. All we think about is these Jules Verne contraptions now, where we, you know, it's all going to be that way.
And it turns out to be not.
That's not it. But you know, it's kind of Star Trek-y, I think too. Everybody kind of predicts the Star Trek future. You know, where it's all these sleek space age rocket ships, starships, and we're all wearing one-piece suits. And we all have tricorders, which we do. We do it. We have the tricorder now.
Which makes the tricorder itself unlikely, in my opinion.
Well,
the fact that we've got it now, I'm like, they're not. So 100, 500 years so, when they're on the Star Trek thing? Mm. Nope.
No, but we've got the voice recognition computers,
right?
You know, where they would walk around and say, computer, do this for me, computer, do that. We can do. You can get in your car now and tell the car to put on
that?
The radio. I don't.
Oh.
And I purposely don't want any of that. My car, I like the car to drive. I want the car.
But the car is, your car is a little bit your friend.
But I like, I do.
So I can't imagine that you would want to not talk to him.
Well, I don't know. I don't want all the electronic stuff in the car. I want a good stereo, and I want a good performance. I don't want touch screens. I think cars shouldn't have touch screens. Cars should have knobs.
I understand that part.
And switches. I'm very purist about that kind of thing. Like I don't want a lot of electronic gadgets in the car. I don't want that.
I think I understand. I mean, because then it's almost not. It's like what we were talking about with football. It's sort of like your car is not an event in that big way. You have a relationship with it, and it's a simple one, and you like that.
I like that. Yeah, I like things that are built for one purpose. I like one purpose boxes. I like electronics that are one purpose. I like a stereo.
I agree.
I like a television set.
Right.
I like the computer. I like them all separate. I don't want my television, computer, stereo box.
Why is that? I feel that way too, and I think that's why I was nostalgic for 2003 when I had my camera in one hand, my phone in another,
agree, yeah.
and another charger, whatever else I was carrying,
maybe
video camera different.
I think it's a bias that you think like maybe they will do that function better because they're purpose-built for that, maybe. And I know that that's completely...
That's part of it.
It's so antiquated, that thinking. It's so far it's our kids will have none of that thought. There's no issue with them. It's just this. I hold this thing in my hand. It does everything.
Yeah.
Anything I could ever need, I can get by touching a screen, and that's fine. For me, I come from a world of pinball machines and analog devices.
The form of the thing is the function of the thing.
Yeah.
And it's not. I think that's the problem with. If you have one device that does everything,
mm-hmm.
at a certain point, you'll be like, oh, I forgot that my iPhone also is a book and I could read it.
Mm-hmm.
You forget a whole, but if you have a book, there, you're going to read it. That's a part of your life in that way. But if it's all folded in there, it becomes invisible. And some of these things that you might do, you forget about because there's no containing object. You don't have a book on your shelf anymore. You have a phone on your shelf or on your desk.
And you end up just doing the same thing you always do with the phone rather than reading that book you intended to.
Right. You won't switch because you'll just look at a couple of videos and go to Wikipedia.
Do you find that that's because of this super age of information, do you find that you actually consume in some ways less than you would have years ago?
Weirdly, first of all, it felt like when you asked me that, like I was an expert and it felt good. Like just the way that I suddenly felt really pretty good about myself. Like, wouldn't it be nice to be considered an expert?
If you want to do, I'll do a full interview segment where I'm interviewing you.
I was so impressed with
as
myself.
An artist, and we'll have a sit down. And you should do that. You should put that in your show.
I felt great.
You know what I mean? It's like.
But your question, yes, and I was thinking
the
about
Sean Hurley interviews, and you have to do it with a British accent because that makes it sound really. BBC
you or I
cool.
do?
Either one. I think we should switch off.
Okay. So sometimes it's you. Whoever has the British accent has to keep their hand up, though. And then they get tired.
Because we're going
to
yeah.
It's like a relay race.
I think we should just randomly switch into British accents. Yeah.
All right, then. See, but it's going to stop us.
You can't think about it. Yeah. If you start thinking about it, then it's going to...
I can't think about anything.
Yeah.
And the moment I do, just gone.
Right.
It shoots it. It's like a duck hunt.
It's like sex. Don't start thinking about it. Just do it.
Right.
Don't start overanalyzing it because you're going to ruin the whole thing.
Right.
Yeah.
I've ruined the whole thing of that.
Don't ruin it.
It's all ruined because I can't... the brain.
It's a lot to think. It's a lot going on. But...
Oh, the experience of... Yes. Well, I feel, I was noticing this the other day. I have a Kindle, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of get, I'm torn. I sometimes will go read a paper book and then I'll go back to the Kindle. And the thing that I love and everybody else loves about the Kindles, you can download samples of books that you might be interested. So the Kurt Vonnegut letters that I've mentioned earlier, Kindle reading,
nice.
Right?
Yeah.
So I've come to the end of my sample, okay? Do I buy it? No. I go get another sample. So I've read 50 samples. That's all I've read in the last 3 months. I haven't read a full book. I've read 50.
I think it just makes you a cheap bastard. Chapters. Is what that makes you.
I read it and I'm like, do I want to buy this? And then my preference is I'd rather have the real book.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. And if I'm going to spend $10, I don't want it to be on a thing that's inside my Kindle. I feel a little like that's not. I would like the real one.
My tangible.
Yeah.
Something that's got weight to it.
So I have that's part of it. So cheap, maybe it's cheap bastard, but part of it is a reluctance to buy in the form that I'm consuming at that moment. I imagine to myself, oh, okay, I'll go to the bookstore. And I'm even reluctant to buy it from Amazon. I mean, I will from time to time, but I still have this thing like I want to go down and get my newspaper at the thing and buy it from the guy. I've never even done that, but I picture myself in New York City.
Someday you will.
giving a newspaper guy who's chewing a cigar 50 cents, no bills, for a New York Times. And none of that, I've never even read the New York Times. I mean, sadly.
Mm.
I've looked at it and touched it. It's very thin and proper paper. But in the same way, I have this bookstore idea. I'll get it at the bookstore. And there really aren't any around anymore. So I don't ever get, but my attention, I definitely feel like part of the culprit is in some ways, my attention is not that deep. I am the world is a channel surf right now for me. I don't want it to be that narrow. And every once in a while I pull back and I'm like, okay, I got to focus. I got to read something.
It's
to
so
the
hard
end.
To do that, though.
It does. It's like if you're going to read a book from, you know, and you actually make it through, you got to focus on it, and it's going to take 2 or 3 weeks, and you're going to miss a lot of new hot videos.
Mm-hmm. Your Twitter feed's going to be so full by then of stuff that you haven't paid attention to.
You're going to miss a ton. You're going to miss all that stuff. You won't be able to retweet anything or read the first paragraph of, I mean, and that's not, this Kindle sample chapter situation extends everywhere for me. I don't watch a complete video. I don't watch or listen to a complete song. I don't read a complete article. I'm reading the first paragraph or maybe two. But after that, I feel like I know enough about what that subject is. Either I know that there's nothing there. You know, there's sometimes a tease about, you know, what's wrong with Harrison Ford's hair? And you're like, I don't know. I'm going to go read about that. And you instantly know this is just, there's nothing wrong with his hair, you know. It's his haircut.
Crisis averted.
Yeah, so you're back to what's next. But everything is like that. I'm a half inch deep into the world, and I can't right now get deeper. I'd like to.
I feel like, you know, years ago, before having access to any kind of music I wanted, any movie, that I savored things a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
When I went and bought an album, first on record, and then I'd buy a disc, it was a big deal. First of all, there was a budget involved. I could only buy so much of it in any 1 month. And then when I got it, I would listen to it again and again. I'd look at the cover art. I'd, you know, try to find magazine articles about the band. It meant something to me. Now, that probably also came from being younger, you know, and being more obsessed with music. But I find when you got a chance to see a movie, it was a kind of a big deal, and you kind of wanted to know more about it. And you would hear about it weeks or months in advance. And we've talked about this before. There was that experience of really being, it was kind of a big deal because it was a rare commodity to some extent. You know, you listen to the radio and some, you know, we got the new album from so-and-so is coming up.
Mm.
Fantastic. I can't wait. I'm going to hear your track from that. And we'd wait an hour for the thing to play. You know, and that was frustrating because there was so much more you wanted to get. And if I had access back then to all of this stuff, it would have been like a kid in a candy store. Well, now we have the candy store. We all have the candy store in our pocket. And, you know, it's like, yeah, I'll try some new things here and there and some things recommended. But you're right. I'm perusing things now. I'm looking at little bits and pieces here and there. Or I'm going back to the same old stuff that I liked before with a little dose of new here and there. I'm reading things. Oh, boy, that's going to take me 15 minutes to read that article. I don't have that time.
Right.
You know, and it's back then, if I had access to that stuff, I would have been, you know, all consuming. And it's like there's just not enough time in the day for all the stuff that's pushed towards you for you to take it all in. And there's stuff now that songs that I would love to listen to, movies I'd like to watch, and it's like, yeah, I'll get to it.
Right.
Thinking that I'll have time someday to watch it. I'll have time someday to listen to that.
Maybe this is a difference between an adult sense of responsibility and a child's sense. I don't know, but I have the same thing when I was younger, and I feel like I brought that into my adulthood, and now it's gone. Where I would, you know, if I liked even one song, maybe from a record, I would get the record and I would come to, you'd get to know it. You know, it'd be become this worn thing. You know, soon it's kind of ratty around the edges. But you'd know when it was, you know, like even the tiny fine print of when it was pressed. You know, you'd know all this dumb and who. Because you read it almost like the back of a cereal box while you're listening to it, because it becomes this intimate object almost for you. And if you see it anywhere else, it's strange. You know, like if you see it at a store, at another version of Led Zeppelin's album, you're like, ooh, that's mine. But you don't feel in a possessive way. You're almost happy to see it, but it feels like it's your friend. But it seems like now we have a different level of responsibility to our cultural awareness. And I get this. This is almost like a pressure I feel on Twitter. So I'm reading about all these different articles and things and videos and that people are tweeting about, you know, Roger Ebert's take on the Golden Globes. Oh, I have to read that. Or But I don't know if that responsibility is a modern responsibility or just because I grew up into this age where suddenly here it is and there's all these things that we're supposed to be in contact with. Whereas when I was young, it seemed like you read the newspaper, maybe you watch the 6 o'clock news, you know, you're free yeah. to go listen to your album for 3 hours.
And be unplugged from the rest of
yeah,
society.
Yeah, you don't have to yeah. do anything else. You don't need to keep up in this way. But there is this sense that we're moving all together along, all of us knowing, you know, did you read today's Slate, you know, mm-hmm. or go to Huffington Post and read this thing and these other places. And this, everything's so disparate yeah. and scattered. I just push away. I give up.
I agree. It used to be, too, that you could, you know, if you went off, say, you like to take a hike and you'd go off for 3 or 4 hours in an afternoon on a Saturday or something, you were gone for even half a day or whatever. Whatever, no big deal. If you are out of touch or unplugged from some kind of network for 3 or 4 hours, you're considered off the grid now. You're setting up a militia.
You're a castaway
up in the North Country. You are you are for some reason you must be you're an anarchist.
Right.
You know, and it's
it does
it's
seem to be a political statement.
It really does. It seems like well why didn't you just take your phone with you? Well, I didn't really want my phone out in the middle of the wilderness. I kind of wanted to walk around for 4 hours and just be alone and kind of listen not
take pictures of yourself and
yeah.
post them.
Well, you didn't want to take pictures every 10 feet of the kids. Like, no, we just wanted to run around out in the woods and look at me like, wow. You're like a naturalist or something. No, not really. You know, I went through the drive-thru on the way home to get a coffee. That's not the point. I just wanted to be unplugged. But you literally, yeah, I think people look at you strangely now when you say, do you get this reaction from people? I've actually said to parents in the past, now I have a smartphone, but I didn't until recently. I had the old flip phone. And sometimes I would forget it, leave it in the car, and it would die. You know, the battery would die. And I would just, for days on end, I wouldn't touch it. And I would get someplace.
You are a holdout.
And people would go, you know, they'd say something like, well, do you want my number? Yeah, let me write it down. And they look at you like, what? It's like, my phone is somewhere in my car. It's dead. I haven't used it in a week. And they'd look at you like, and there would be that awkward silence. Like, you want me to write this down in a post-it note for you? And I'd be like, I'll write it. You just have to give me the numbers. And they're like, I don't know. I have to look at my phone. You just punch it into your phone. And they literally, no, your phone, your device, where's your thing? I don't have it. And I feel like alarms are going off in some office. Some are like, we have a runner. You know, it's Blade Runner. It's like, wait a minute, I just forgot, no! You know, I feel like I'm going to be taken away because I'm a bad parent or something because I don't have constant contact at all times with the device in my hand. I have to be tagged.
There is a lot of peculiar peer pressure these days mm-hmm. around phones, around technology, around social media. There is a sort of a sense of what is an acceptable way to be.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't feel right. Like you're a recent Twitter joint. You just joined.
I just joined it couple of weeks ago. Yeah,
that goes really hand in hand with your cell phone
problem. I had to be forced contractually to do it.
Did you get forced contractually?
I was told that this must be done. This was put in writing.
The hammer came down.
I must become a social media person of some sort. That I must. And I refuse to make my Facebook account a public situation. To me, that's a very private. It's just friends and family and selected colleagues. So they said, okay, but Twitter is your thing. We gotta get all our radio hosts Twitterified.
See, and now
I must be a Twitter person apparently.
Now, what do you do about that? Do you every day go, I know I'm gonna tweet?
Yes.
And then what do you do?
It's a chore.
Do you ask?
I haven't been doing it every day.
Do you go like, "Hey Taylor, what should I tweet?"
I just mostly it's retweeting what other people do. I don't.
Do you quip?
I have like maybe
snipe.
I don't even know. Is that yeah? I tweet. I'm a twit. I don't know what I'm supposed to do with it.
You tweet.
I understand it, obviously, and it is pretty cool. Oh. It's not that I don't think it's not interesting.
You have to say this part of your contract.
But it's just another thing.
Right.
It's another account to sign into to check, and my thing about it is, and I could build up a big base of people at some point. I doubt I will because I'm not that driven on it. But even if I did, the truth of the matter is, for someone like me, I'm never going to reach a critical mass of people like I would on the radio.
Right.
The radio, I'm going to
talk.
That's
where you're talking.
I will talk to tens of thousands of people in any one day, and my Twitter feed will never get up to that because I'm not that kind of celebrity. Right. Very few people will ever get to that critical mass where it's just...
It explodes.
It's just exploding.
Right. And so, it sort of self-explodes and continues to explode.
So for me, it's got to be proportional with the time.
Right.
You know, if I'm talking to 50 people or 25 people or whatever it is, and at any one point, one or two care about what I'm saying.
Right.
How proportional... How much time does it take out of my day to do something?
Right. I think the peculiar thing about Twitter, I still have Twitter resistance. It's just built into me. It'll never fade. It'll always be there.
Mm-hmm.
When I first went into Twitter land, and I did it pretty early. It wasn't like the early adopters, which I don't even, that's even passe now, calling people early adopters. But when I looked at Twitter, I didn't have any idea what I was looking at. The stream of the people that you're following, the stream of information. And what is remarkable about Twitter is, on the one hand, we have the sense that we have 124 characters to make our points, whatever we want to do. That limited bit, there's that limited sense of what you're going to put out there. But if I look over my Twitter stream, I have, 20 little comments from different people that I'm following. But there's maybe two that I understand. As I'm looking over that, a lot of these things are responses to other people,
mm-hmm.
jokes about things I don't get.
It's all inside.
Links to things that I don't care about. I'm scanning over just hieroglyphics of different things, and then my eye will catch on something, and I'll read it. But it's amazing to me that this information tool itself is almost completely blurred by masses of, to me, at the moment, unintelligible information. So I find that almost like a phenomena of what it's supposed to be and what my actual user experience is. It's supposed to be presenting me with information, but most of it is like the Matrix. I'm just looking at numbers
past. That's a good point. It's supposed to be, the whole point of all of that is supposed to filter down to things that are of the essence that you care about. It's supposed to help you filter out the extraneous and be just pertinent from the people and sources that you would want to read about. Yet it doesn't really work that way. It ends up just being, like you said, this ongoing stream of consciousness of inside jokes from other people. And it's like Facebook that ends up being a lot of pictures of other people's kids and cats.
Right.
You know, and as useful a tool as both can be, and I do find ways to use them both for what I want, it's not a simple plug-and-play thing for me that I think I would have thought they were going to be in the beginning.
Right.
It's become more of a daily chore in some ways.
But one last thing about Twitter and Facebook. I find that when I'm going to go on to Twitter, and I've noticed this, my mind subtly adjusts and my eyes shift to prepare for the experience of absorbing information in a particular way. You go on Facebook, you're going to see pictures and you're going to see lines of paragraphs. I go on to that pretty quiet. I'll read Facebook. But if I go into Twitter, it's like some sort of mechanism rears up behind me,
you
my
shift
brain.
Gears.
Yeah, and I'm like, I'm ready to see hashtags and strange at this person, and I'm ready to move through it in this particular way. I feel like if they looked at my brain, I would be shifting in this odd way that I don't do anywhere
else.
Some
areas light up.
Yeah, like I'm looking at a strange eye chart that is three-dimensional. And that's another thing. And I have a resistance to looking at Twitter because that fatigues me.